Peter, you can head to the classroom in the back down the right side of the hallway. And tonight we're going to continue our study in the intertestamental period. I'll move up here because I'll be blocking anybody's view. Primarily we are in the book of Daniel more than any other book. We call it the intertestamental period, but Daniel has a few things to say about this time period, and in particular, chapter 2 and chapter 7 of the book, Nebuchadnezzar has been given this dream where he's been shown what the future holds, in essence, and Daniel interprets the dream, and although he doesn't specifically identify all of the kingdoms, we can figure it out pretty easily. So the Babylonian Empire will be succeeded by the Medo-Persian Empire, to be succeeded by the Greek Empire, to be succeeded eventually by the Roman Empire. And then in chapter 7, Daniel has a vision of these four different creatures, which symbolize the same great four world empires. And we'll come back to this next week, probably, because there are several times where this one particular ruler is referred to. And I anticipate that in the class tonight we'll get up to that king and then be ready to talk about him. So he's mentioned there in chapter 7, and then he's mentioned quite extensively in chapter 11. And then in chapter 8, we have this vision as well that Daniel has of the ram that is killed by the goat. And so in chapter 8, in this vision, we do have the kingdoms identified, that the ram is Persia. And you remember it was emphasized in the vision that this ram had two big horns, and the second horn, the latter horn, was bigger than the first one. And this is a rather even interesting little detail, because the Persians started out as the Median part of the empire was much bigger than the Persian part of the empire. And Cyrus was able to take over the Median empire. He actually rebelled against his own grandfather to take over this empire, and so the Persians came to surpass the Medes, and so the Persian, we know of it as the Persian Empire rather than the Median Empire. And so even that little detail is envisioned in the two horns and their relative sizes here. And then Greece, that has this goat with this gigantic horn that spears the ram and kills it and tramples it. And how that's Greece, and clearly Alexander the Great and his short reign, and the horn is broken off and replaced by four smaller horns. And you see this constant reference to four coming up. The leopard was a four-headed leopard back in chapter 7, which represents the Greek Empire. Now we have four horns replacing the horn of Alexander the Great, and also the four points of the compass in chapter 11. And this was the other main passage we looked at last week that's fulfilled in Alexander the Great. So at the very beginning of this chapter, Daniel is given a vision, and there are these three Persian kings, and then there'll be a fourth, and he will rouse people to attack Greece, which appears to be a reference to Xerxes, and yet the kingdom of Greece will prevail. And his kingdom will then be divided to the four winds, and his kingdom will be left to others that are not his descendants, and their rule will not equal his own. And that's clearly what happens with the disintegration of Alexander the Great's empire. He had a son that wasn't born yet when he died, and he had a half-brother who was mentally defective, and so he really had no heir to speak of. And certainly the kingdoms that resulted after his death were not nearly as powerful as his. So after he dies, nobody can hold the empire together. They're really just a series of civil disturbances and wars between the generals as various ones get on top. But as soon as one guy gets on top, all the others gang up on him. And so the empire eventually settles into these four basic areas, with the most prominent rulers being Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. And the two we're interested in are the two highlighted in yellow at the bottom, because if you know your geography, back in Old Testament times, the two great superpowers of the world were in Egypt or Mesopotamia. And right smack in the between these two great powers, where do we find? Well, there's Israel. You know, you think about that. Whose bright idea was it to put Israel right there in between these warring superpowers? Yeah, it was God. He could have put them in Australia, right? Or Great Britain, or you know, the South Pole. You know, God chose where to plant Israel, and He clearly wanted to plant them right in the middle of everything. Well, that same location is going to put Palestine right in between these two warring kingdoms, the Greek kingdom of the Ptolemies down in Egypt, and the Greek kingdom of the Seleucids, which rule everything from Asia Minor to India. And so if we were to look at a map, this is kind of what it looks like. You can see where Cassander and Lysimachus are in control, way off over here in Greece, so that really doesn't impact what's going on in Palestine. But the Ptolemies control northern Africa, Egypt, on up into Palestine, and then the Seleucids control everything from modern-day Turkey to India. So they've got the lion's share of the empire that they've inherited. So you can see the four basic sections that Alexander's empire fell into. And next we turn our attention to these two. And in Daniel chapter 11, throughout that chapter, in this vision, these prophecies that Daniel is given, it constantly talks about the king of the south and the king of the north. And this clearly is the rulers of the Ptolemaic kingdom down in Egypt versus the Seleucid rulers, which are coming down from the north. You could say, well, most of this seems to be to the east. But as you remember from even when the Assyrians and the Babylonians came over, because they have to go over the desert, they always come from the north. And there's that constant theme throughout the prophets of the invader from the north. So we got this king of the north who comes down, wages war with the king of the south, and vice versa. And it's talking about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids vying for power, and they're always struggling and fighting over Palestine, because that's the meeting place between these two great factions. So, what happens? Well, again, Alexander dies in 323, and it's really with the death of Antigonus in 301 that Alexander's kingdom finally settles down into these four major sections. So from about the year 300 down to the year 200, for that 100-year period, Palestine, where all of the Jews who've gone back to the Promised Land are living, they are living under the rule of these Greeks of Egyptian rule, the Ptolemies. And the reason Palestine is ruled by the Ptolemies is because when they had that big battle to fight against Antigonus, the one-eyed, before they had the battle, they said, now how are we going to divvy up all the territory when we win? And so the agreement was that because Ptolemy was contributing some forces and some boats and so on, that he would get Palestine. And then, you know, the others got various other territories. Well, that's fine and good. However, Ptolemy's forces missed the battle. You know, they got caught by a train or something. They couldn't show up in time. Well, there was a deep suspicion by the Seleucids, particularly, that Ptolemy was just trying to play both sides of the war here. And so the Seleucids considered, well, that agreement's void now. You're not entitled to Palestine. But possession's 9/10 of the law, and you know, there wasn't much they could do about it at the time. But that's what causes this kind of century-long turmoil, bad blood between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And so we got to get Palestine back. It rightfully belongs to us because the Ptolemies didn't do their part in the war against Antigonus. During this period, a lot of Jews are going to move to Alexandria, and there'll be a very large Jewish population there. And this is when the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, is made, somewhere around 250 to 200 B.C. And the battles and conflicts between these two powerful kingdoms are detailed in Daniel chapters 10 through 12, particularly chapter 11. And so what we'll see tonight is how this will take us down to about the year 200 when the Seleucids will finally take over Palestine. So for the first 100 years, the Ptolemies controlled Palestine, and for the next 100 years, we'll just say for round terms, the Seleucids will control Palestine. Now, if you'd talk to a typical Jew on the street and said, would you rather be ruled by the Ptolemies or the Seleucids? What do you think he would have said?
Yes.
Yeah, one Greek's the same as another. You know, it wouldn't matter to them. Greeks are Greeks, and it's not any big difference between them. Well, that's what you'd think, but you'd be wrong, as it turns out. This is a bust of Ptolemy the First, by the way, just give you something to look at there. Now let's look at Daniel chapter 11, at some of these passages in particular. And some of these are a matter of some speculation because they're general enough that their fulfillment might have been in a couple of different things, but at least some of these will be possible identifications of what's being talked about here. So let's notice Daniel chapter 11. Now, the first four verses we read last time, which speaks of the rising of these Persian kings and fighting against the empire of Greece and how that will quickly fall apart. Now, what you'll notice is the Persian period, which is several hundred years, is covered in verse 2. So he's not wanting to focus on that. And Alexander the Great is covered in two verses, verse 3 and 4. And then we're going to come to the Ptolemaic Seleucid conflict, which will carry us from verse 5 down through verse 20, and that'll cover about a 100-year period. And then, beginning in verse 21, he talks about Antiochus Epiphanes specifically, and you'll notice the bulk of the chapter is about him specifically. And so this one king and his very short reign of 11 years that he ruled in Palestine. So it's pretty obvious what the vision here is intended to do. We're skipping very quickly across Persian history and the early Greek period, and we're getting down to Antiochus Epiphanes because that's the real focus of what God wants to tell his people through Daniel. All right, well, let's go ahead and read these verses partway and then see if we can make some correlations. So beginning in verse 5, then the king of the south, or the Ptolemies, will grow strong along with one of his princes who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His domain will be a great dominion indeed. All right, so who are these people? Well, this is Ptolemy the First and Seleucus the First. And that's a bust of Seleucus the First. Looks a little more demonic to me than the other guy. And these were two powerful men, generals in Alexander's rule, had campaigned with Alexander. And what you find in this passage is a reference to the fact that Seleucus had been assigned dominance over in Babylon. He was appointed the satrap of Babylon. But that was before Antigonus was defeated. And Antigonus chased him out of Babylon. And he flees to Egypt, and Ptolemy gives him refuge there and protects him until Antigonus is defeated, and finally Seleucus can go and take his stake his claim to his territory again. And I think that's what you find reference here to, that Ptolemy is ruling down in Egypt. He's giving a sanctuary to Seleucus, but Seleucus winds up becoming of greater prominence and having greater territory and wealth than Ptolemy even. And so he becomes not just on par with Ptolemy, but surpassing him. And now after some years, verse 6, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement, but she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. Well, this is a reference to the fact that Ptolemy the Second's daughter, her name was Bernice, she is married off to Seleucus the Second. This is about the year 250, and this is an attempt to form an alliance. You know how these political marriages were done to secure peace among kingdoms. That's probably why Solomon had so many marriages. They were more political than anything. But so that's the attempt here. Well, what happened as a result of this? Well, because of a lot of political intrigue and so on, the whole thing just became a mess, and a lot of people were killed, and a kind of a coup of sorts. And so it happened exactly like Daniel envisioned here in verse 6. So that didn't work out very well. All right, verse 7 and 8. But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength, and also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity to Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. And so here is Ptolemy III now, who has a series of successful campaigns all the way over to Babylon even, and sacks the city of Seleucia and takes a lot of wealth back to Egypt, which seems the most likely reference to his success here. Then, verse 9, then the latter, that is the king of the north, the Seleucids, will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. And so this is Seleucus II, who attempts to invade Egypt, and he doesn't get very far. And so this is the year 242, so that whole thing turned out to be a fiasco. All right, then, verse 10, his sons, that is the king of the north's sons, will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. So this is in reference to the sons of Seleucus II. And so his two sons were Seleucus III and Antiochus III. And again, it's you know, hard to keep a lot of these things straight here. Seleucus III, he ruled from about 225 to 223. So he had a very short-lived rule. And then his brother took over, Antiochus III, and he comes to be known as Antiochus the Great because he has a great deal of success during the time of his rule. Now, I think verse 10 is kind of a general statement about Antiochus's rule, and then in verse 11 backs up and gives us some of the detail of this time period. So, the king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. And then the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. And when the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, and yet he will not prevail. So what you find a reference to here is in the year 217, Ptolemy IV, he wins a great battle over the forces of Antiochus III at a place called Raphia, which is modern-day Gaza. And so this looks like the Ptolemies have the upper hand now. But as you can see here, as hinted at the end of verse 12, this isn't going to last because Antiochus turns right around and defeats the forces of the Ptolemies once again, and this time it's decisive. And the Ptolemies are permanently pushed out of Palestine, and from this point on, Palestine will be under the control of the Seleucids. So the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, and after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. And so this has reference to the Battle of Panea or Banias. It's called by several different names. It's up near Caesarea Philippi, where the Jordan River has its beginning. So this was just a site of a great battle that took place between Antiochus III. Now, Ptolemy V at this time is just a little kid. So he's not in charge. He's not leading any armies in battle. That's really part of the problem here. There's a lot of intrigue going on in Egypt. No one's really in control. Things are in turmoil. Everybody's vying for power to rule in the name of this child. And in that kind of disarray, the Seleucids obviously take advantage of that. And so this is the decisive battle that brings an end to this perpetual war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, or at least from this point on, the Ptolemies don't have much hope. They won't have any success against the Seleucids. And so everything's looking up here at this point. Verse 14, "Now in those times many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down." And this appears to be a reference to the several civil disturbances and insurrections that were experienced during the reign of the childhood of Ptolemy V. And apparently, it says even a lot of the Jewish people are kind of getting on the bandwagon here and encouraging this process. But then, verse 15 through 17, "Then the king of the north will come, cast up a siege mound, capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. And he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect, and he will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side." All right, so what does this have reference to? Well, I think this is a restatement of the decisive victory of the Seleucids over the Ptolemies. And having accomplished this great victory, now Antiochus is going to try this same make peace and seal it with a political marriage. And so he marries off his daughter, Cleopatra. She's the first one to bear this name. He marries off Cleopatra to Ptolemy V. So this is in the year 193. Ptolemy V has grown up a little bit by now. Still not that old, but so this is a political marriage here that's going to secure, his rule over Egypt. That's his plan. Well, it didn't work out because Cleopatra sides with Ptolemy against her own father. So she won't be used as a pawn in this game. It didn't bring about the complete domination of Egypt like he envisioned that it would. The beautiful land in verse 16 is what, do you think? Yeah, it's the promised land. So this is a reference again to the fact that Antiochus has taken over Palestine and is now ruling that. All right, now verse 18 and 19, "He will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn, so he will turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more." Well, this is very easy to identify, verses 18 through 19. A series of events that take place, 192, 191, 190. So 192, Antiochus is powerful enough, he thinks that he can invade Greece. And he's going to expand the kingdom. This is kind of a reverse of what Alexander did, come over from Greece and invade Persia. Well, he's pretty much controlling the old Persian Empire, and he's going to invade Greece. And he's successful for a while, but then he is defeated at all places, Thermopylae, same place, with the 300 guys. That was a different war many centuries before. But he's defeated, and so he retreats across the Aegean Sea, and he's defeated again at a place called Magnesia. Now, who defeated him in these two great battles? You know your world history. Well, I remember, Alexander's dead, so that's old news. Well, the Romans. Yeah, the Romans, the old republic at this point, but they're going to prevail. So they're rising as a power in the Mediterranean world, and of course they're that fourth empire that's going to come after the Greek, and this is where we find Rome starting to exert its influence in the East. And that's going to become foreshadowing of what's going to happen in the New Testament, because, of course, by the time we get down to Jesus, the Caesars are in power and Palestine's ruled by a Roman governor and all of that. And that helps to explain how all that comes about. Joe?
Sir, was Rome in control of Greece at this time, or the descendants of Alexander's kingdom were still controlling Greece?
Descendants of Alexander, remnants of Alexander's empire, are still in control of Greece at this time. It's not until the latter end of the 2nd century BC that Rome will finally take full control of that. They fight a series of four wars. They call the four Macedonian Wars to take over. And that's where we're doing our study on Sunday morning at Corinth. You remember Adam talked Sunday morning about how the Romans came and wiped out the city of Corinth as the head of the Achaean League. That was one of those steps that the Romans did in order to secure control over Greece. But at this point, Rome hasn't quite have that kind of power. Their power is more like, the people in Greece realize they're not powerful enough to take on Antiochus, and so they say, Romans, will you please help us? And they invite them in to assist them. And of course, Rome thinks it's in their best interest to weaken the Seleucids, because a weaker, if he's a major power, you weaken him, that's going to help yourself. And so the Romans don't let the grass grow under their feet. So after having defeated Antiochus at Thermopylae, they chase him on over to Magnesia. And so the defeat at Magnesia was pretty decisive. And as a consequence of this, Antiochus makes a treaty with the Romans. And as a consequence of that treaty, he gives up all of Turkey, all of Asia Minor. He says, we renounce our control and claim over that territory, and all of the income from that is gone. And on top of that, Rome said, you're going to pay X number of dollars every year in tribute to Rome. And it was a pretty hefty tribute that was levied against the Seleucids. And this single event is going to put them in such financial bind that they're going to have trouble with this from here on out. This is really the beginning of the end for the Seleucids. And we'll see how all that plays into Antiochus Epiphanes later on. Antiochus the IV, not this one, this is Antiochus the III. And so it says that he will withdraw, and he will stumble and fall and be found no more. And in fact, on his retreat from Magnesia, he was plundering a place at Elymas, and he died there. And so he came to a rather sudden end, and that's the end of his rule. And so he's then succeeded by his son Seleucus the IV, and Seleucus the IV is in such dire financial straits that he's looking for money wherever he can. And so he has this tax man, Heliodorus, to go and try to collect some money from the Jews in Palestine. And the guy actually plunders the temple to collect some of the temple tax there under the ruse that part of that should belong to the Seleucid Empire. And that's referred to now in verse 20. Then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor or an exactor of tribute through the jewel of his kingdom, that is to Jerusalem itself. And yet within a few days he will be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle. Well, he's not going to die of old age. He's not going to die in battle. He's going to be assassinated. In fact, Heliodorus assassinates Seleucus the IV. The tax man cometh. Death and taxes here combined in the same fella. And so, again, a pretty short-lived, uneventful rule by Antiochus's son, Seleucus. So, where does that leave things? Well, that's what's going to set the stage now for this next ruler, who is Antiochus the IV. And you'll notice a pattern. These Seleucid rulers, every other one's named Antiochus and every other one's named Seleucus. They alternate back and forth. And the Ptolemies just Ptolemy 1, 2, 3, 4, on down. So let's go back and recap now. That's what Daniel chapter 11, verses 5 through 20, in vision and prophesied in pretty specific detail. And what we've seen is how all of these details, in fact, unfolded. Now, your skeptic's going to say, well, obviously, whoever wrote Daniel chapter 11 had to do it after all these events happened. And so that will also include what he has to say about Antiochus the Fourth here in the next few verses. And so that takes you all the way down to the year 164. And so they'll say, oh, the book of Daniel couldn't have been written until, you know, 164, 163 at the earliest. Well, if you don't believe in prophecy, I guess you have to conclude that. But if you believe God can predict the future, that's not an issue. So what happens with the Seleucids? Well, you remember around the year 200 or 198 specifically, they take control of Palestine. And that's significant for the Jews living in Palestine. He uses Greek culture or Hellenism to kind of help unify his empire. Now, you remember his empire is everything from the western end of Turkey to India. And that covers a lot of different peoples, different cultures, a lot of different ways of doing things, different philosophies. Whereas the Ptolemies just have Egypt. So it's a kind of a single culture down there. The Seleucids got this wide-ranging, far-flung, huge geographic region to control. And so Greek culture is the one thing we all share together. And so that's kind of used to help unify the empire together. The Jews had a great deal of freedom under Antiochus III, and so they had no particular reason to complain about their treatment and so on. So again, their condition was pretty much the same as it was under the Ptolemies. But what the Seleucids failed to do, of course, was they were big supporters of Carthage. Matter of fact, Hannibal seeks refuge with Antiochus III, Hannibal, the great general, you know, yeah, the elephants and all that. Well, he's counseling the Seleucids to take on Rome and be aggressive and invade Greece and all of that. And, of course, the Phoenician army or navy has always been the navy of the Seleucid Empire. And, of course, the Carthaginians are Phoenician. You know, that Carthage was just a colony of the Phoenicians. So they have thrown their support behind Carthage. Well, of course, looking back historically, Carthage is the loser and Rome's the winner. And so once Rome puts down Carthage in the west of the Mediterranean Sea and they start expanding their power to the east, they're not going to forget who sided with whom. And so this is one of the reasons the Romans are particularly eager to kind of tweak the nose of the Seleucids. They picked the wrong side. We're the winners and you're going to pay. So that famous feud between Carthage and Rome kind of slops over here to what's going on in Palestine with the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And so, as we said in 190 at Magnesia, Antiochus III is defeated by Rome and put under this crushing tribute. Now, I think I got a map here to kind of help illustrate this. So Magnesia is located all the way here on the coast, west coast of modern-day Turkey. And this is where the Romans come in and do battle with Antiochus's forces. And so as a result, again, everything north of the Taurus mountain range here is given up, and it's divvied out to the friends of Rome. And then the Seleucids retain their power over here. So, this blow-up of the Palestine here shows where the Battle of Panea or Banaeus took place. That was the battle that secured control of Palestine for the Seleucids, you'll remember, and drove the Ptolemies out of the region. So, you know, things were looking good at that point, but now with the Romans intervening, things are not looking so good anymore. All right, I'll pause here if there's any questions or comments. Nathan?
I might have my details mixed up. Am I correct in remembering that part of the treaty and the deal at Magnesia was that Antiochus IV was kind of carried away as a prisoner of war for a while?
Yes, he was taken hostage because he was one of the sons of Antiochus III. But when Antiochus died, then you know, Seleucus becomes, king for a short while. Let me see. I'm going to get this, straightened out here. I have to come back and check on that because I think what happened was Seleucus was actually a hostage, and that gave Antiochus IV a chance to usurp his throne, is what took place there. But we'll come back and look at him. So if you want to be looking ahead a little bit for next time, you'll notice picking up in verse 21, in his place, that is, Seleucus IV is that very short-lived rule. In his place, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And so he usurps the throne. It wasn't rightfully his. The rightful king was in prison or held hostage by the Romans. And so this introduces us to Antiochus IV, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And he will reign from 175 down to 164. And his nickname, Epiphanes, tells you something. When you talk about people having an epiphany, that means they, it's like the light comes on and they see something, it's a revelation. So he takes this nickname as if to say he is the revelation of God on the earth. You know, he's the manifestation of the divine presence. So if that doesn't tell you something about his opinion of himself, I don't know what will. And it's this despicable person that Daniel is deeply concerned about. And if you go back to chapter 7, this is the same person that is referred to as well as the other horn that springs up and speaks blasphemous things. So, we'll explore this and see all this is fulfilled in Antiochus. And the reason Daniel is interested in this character is because this is the guy who instigates this severe persecution against God's people. And the thing you have to keep in mind is the ultimate reason the Jews go through this severe persecution is what? Well, God wanted them to, right? I mean, God could have avoided it. God could have seen to it. They were spared. God intends for them to go through this. And so God has some purpose in this. And years before, God uses Daniel to tell the people ahead of time what's going to happen so they at least have something to hang their hat on and to be able to say, I know we can get through this. I know there's some purpose for this. God is up to something. We can look back and see the track record of how all these other prophecies have come true so we can be confident that what God promises is going to come through this persecution or what's on the other side of it is just as sure as the things that have happened before that. Lawson.
Is this the guy that desecrated the temple?
Yes. Yeah, I had a pig sacrificed on the altar and all of that. So if you want to be reading up on him a little bit or reading Daniel chapter 11 from verse 21 on, you'll be in good stead for what we're going to be talking about next week. So we'll explore Antiochus IV then.